From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week's coverage of swine flu, or as we've been instructed to call it now, the H1N1 virus, was pretty scary, especially on cable. And this oft-played soundbite from World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan certainly didn't help.
It really is all of humanity that is under threat.
Here's how CNN's Rick Sanchez responded to that.
It really doesn't get more serious than that now, does it? If you inhabit Earth, you are in danger of being infected.
Some newspapers tried to put the Stage 5 imminent pandemic in perspective. A headline from Thursday's LA Times read, "Scientists see this flu strain as relatively mild." But according to NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, reporters simply can't resist a panic story. Kleinenberg has written about past disasters, most notably in his 2002 book, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. He's been getting calls from reporters this week asking him to talk about the widespread panic in response to H1N1. The only problem? There is no widespread panic. Tell that to the ABCNews.com reporter who contacted him.
The email said that they're looking for someone who could talk about the way the public reacts in panics. And then she goes on, think fallout shelters, anthrax scares, and buying duct tape before the Iraq War. She just wants someone quotable who can give me a behavioral perspective on all of this.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, the problem is, if there's one finding that's consistent in the sociology of disasters over the last, say, five decades, it's that when there are crises, people don't panic. And yet, no matter how hard we try to make this point, we always get emails and phone calls along these lines. So I immediately responded in an email and said, look, I'd be more than happy to speak with you. But here's the thing. It turns out that sociology of disaster will mostly tells us that people don't panic in general. And furthermore, if we look specifically at what's happening here in New York City, I don't see any signs of panic. I walk to work and haven't seen a single person wearing a mask at this point. No violence, no screaming, no people keeping their kids home from school en masse. And I said, look, even at Mexico City, I'm seeing images of people who are being cautious, far more people wearing masks. But the scenes from the streets that we've seen in the news, at least, don't suggest that there's panic.
Well, that sounds like a sober-sided corrective. How did the story come out?
The headline of the piece is Swine Flu Snafu, Ernst & Young episode reveals pandemic panic. And then the kind of lead story is that there was a case where one worker at Ernst & Young went home sick, and many people were concerned that that worker had developed swine flu. But then they later verified that it was not a case of swine flu. So
sounds terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no, exactly. I mean, there's no evidence even in the lead anecdote for what became a five-page story about panic in the United States. The best they could do was a story where there doesn't seem to be any panic whatsoever. But then I really got concerned as I started to leaf through the site, because it turns out they have these images, kind of like collages. And the things we see include a mushroom cloud, a large man in a hazmat suit. We see a scientist who seems to be working through samples, a giant pig snout, and then an insect of some kind. As a sociologist, I hesitate to say what kind of insect it is, but it looks very scary. It also seems to have nothing to do with the pandemic flu situation that we might be entering into. Another very disturbing thing for me about this experience I had with the reporter is that, of course, my response to her was, the concept you have on panic might not fit in this case, so we should be cautious. And my note became the cautionary part of the story told on page 5 of the 5-page report. Mm-hmm. The most puzzling part of it was the section title was, Not Enough Panic? Maybe we should be freaking out right now.
Well, part of this probably has to do with the 24-hour news cycle. We know that unless we promote something as being of enormous importance, and you can't keep people in their seats tuned to that channel. I mean, that's so obvious it's a cliche.
That's true, but to what length are we willing to go to get that kind of attention? So, for instance, I started following the news more closely than I normally do these past few days, and CNN reported that tens of millions of people could possibly die if this flu outbreak is uncontained. There was a clip I saw of a CNN political reporter at a White House press conference with the Department of Homeland Security personnel, at which he pressed over and over again, are there any signs that this flu outbreak is a consequence of a bioterrorist attack? And the Department of Homeland Security representative said, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. This seems to be completely natural. So she pushed again and said, but you can't rule it out, can you? And then later in her report, she said, well, the DHS is denying that this is a bioterrorist attack, but it's still very early in the story and we don't know what there is to know. So there's just no clear reason for us to be thinking about bioterrorism at a moment like this. There certainly isn't reason to be concerned about a mushroom cloud.
And you would say that there are lots of examples of widespread scaremongering, or is it focused on certain news outlets?
Well, my favorite story, in fact, involves the New York Daily News, which sent one of their reporters around the streets of Manhattan in a surgical mask, and they had him cough to see what kind of attention he would whip up. And of course, lots of people looked and thought this was a weird thing. But the best part of the story is that there was a British TV crew that had come to the United States to capture how Americans were responding to this enormous outbreak of swine flu, and they stopped the guy and said they wanted to film him. So here, this is the defining moment of a media event. It should be taught in media studies courses for eternity. You get the reporter who becomes the symbol of how Americans are acting, even though no one else on the streets is doing this.
But don't you also see a lot of reporters saying, don't panic?
You do. And I think many responsible reporters are trying to figure out how you walk this line between reporting on what is clearly a story that deserves our attention and real concern, and reporting in such a way that it becomes sensationalist and scaremongering. Now, there are many good ways to do this, but clearly warning that tens of millions of people could die and giving us images of a nuclear holocaust on a website is not the way to go.
Eric, thank you very much.
Great to be here.
Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology at New York University and author of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media.
The last time the words swine flu were prevalent in the news, Gerald Ford was in the White House and the United States was gearing up to celebrate its bicentennial.
The threat of swine flu outbreak this year is still very, very genuine. Data from the scientific community clearly supports the need for a full-scale inoculation program.
In February of 1976, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare F. David Matthews said, ominously, quote, the projections are that this virus will kill 1 million Americans. That year, President Ford was vaccinated on television as part of a media photo op and through a series of public service announcements urged all Americans to embrace wide-scale flu shots.
A swine flu epidemic may be coming.
I'm the healthiest 55-year-old you ever seen. Hey, I play golf every weekend.
Get a shot of protection. The swine flu shot.
Science writer Patrick DiGiusto, who chronicled the 1976 scare in Ceylon, says it all began then with Army Private David Lewis. He was stationed at Fort Dix, New Jersey, set to go on a 50-mile overnight hike with the rest of his platoon when he came down with the flu. But that didn't stop him.
He went on the hike and died. Now, normally 19-year-olds don't die when they have the flu, and this set off a huge panic. And they discovered that the flu that he had was swine flu, somewhat similar to the flu that wiped out a good portion of the world in 1918.
Now, your piece in Ceylon documented a convergence of a number of factors. One of them was the death of this Army private. Another was politics in the Republican Party as President Ford tried to get the nomination for a next run at the presidency.
California Governor Ronald Reagan put up a spirited fight against Ford. It came to a head on March 23, 1976, when Reagan won the North Carolina primary. President Ford, the very next day, gathered together the nation's top immunologists and held a press conference about how he was going to save the country against the coming plague.
And if that weren't a fertile enough environment for overreaction, came the deaths of several American Legionnaires in Philadelphia. How did that play into the panic?
Between March, when the news about swine flu really reached the public, and August, the scientists really started to calm down. They had analyzed the disease that killed Private Lewis a lot better, and they realized that it probably was not going to be a 1918-style pandemic. Then the Legionnaires' disease happened. Immediately, almost every media outlet covering this saw death. The New York Post first headline was, "Killer fever, 21 dead, 134 ill." The very next day, two more deaths. Mortality rate hits 22%. Now, the original Spanish flu in 1918 had a 2.5% mortality rate. Here they're screaming that the mortality rate of this disease is 10 times higher. A few days later, the New York Post calmed down and its headline read, "Killer fever, it's not flu."
Now, your piece goes into some exquisite detail describing the politics in Congress over what happened after the Legionnaire's disease and an on-again, off-again, on-again national inoculation program. But to make a long story short, Congress did authorize such a program, and virtually every American was to get an anti-flu vaccine for free. And then what happened?
The flu program started on October 1st. It went well. People were lining up, were getting immunized as they should. And then on the night of October 11th in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, three elderly people died within a few hours of getting their flu shot. Mass media panic once again.
Now, this turned out to be a classic example of correlation, not necessarily implying causation.
Exactly.
You described the media freak out, but there was one voice of calm and reason, and that was
Walter Cronkite. The CDC had pointed out that throughout this immunization campaign, there will be coincidences. Someone who was going to have a heart attack that day will get the flu shot and then have their heart attack, and it'll be almost impossible to stop people from connecting the two. When all this happened, Walter Cronkite came on and gave one of his rare commentaries where he actually spanked his media colleagues a bit, telling them that this was not the way they should be behaving.
Now, let's bring this back to 2009. It seems to me that the press itself has been fairly responsible in the coverage so far. Do you agree?
Well, not entirely. I mean, I've seen people out there asking, and it's always done in the form of a question, is this the new Black Death? I mean, I've actually heard that.
All that in news, weather, and sports after this.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Patrick DeJusto is a science writer based in New York City.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
You know, the White House has said this 100-day thing doesn't really mean anything, and yet they've sure made a lot of it all day.
You could say it's been a bit more than 3 months, or you could say 14, 15 weeks or so. But somehow, 100 days became the convention.
Aides have wanted to call the 100-day marker a hallmark holiday, sort of a meaningless holiday that they feel like they're stuck celebrating. But they no longer look like they're stuck about it. They're almost acting as if it's a victory lap.
This whole notion of 100 days, has the White House kind of embraced this notion?
Yeah, they have come out and said, oh, this is just a Hallmark card anniversary. But in fact, they've decided to take advantage of it. Witness the fact the president's holding a news conference tonight. We've all had conversations.
We at OTM also want to exploit the 100-day marker to look at just how transparent this administration, which promised to be the most see-through ever, really is. At Obama's Wednesday night press conference, he issued a public explanation for his administration's invocation of the state secrets privilege, through which the government can scuttle a court case on grounds that it might endanger national security.
I actually think that the state secret doctrine should be modified. I think right now it's overbroad. But keep in mind what happens is we come into office, we're in for a week, and suddenly we've got a court filing that's coming up. And so we don't have the time to effectively think through what exactly should a overarching reform of that doctrine take. We've got to respond to the immediate case in front of us.
Okay, but that's why courts grant extensions. So notes Elizabeth Goitein of the Brennan Center for Justice, who co-authored a transparency report card on the Obama administration's first 100 days. She joins us. Elizabeth, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
You gave the Obama administration an F for its use of state secrets. Does his explanation at the press conference at all make you want to change his grade?
if the administration is serious about discontinuing this extreme use of the state secrets privilege, then that is commendable and it is certainly good news. However, I do feel that his explanation that he essentially did not have time to come up with a position on state secrets is a little bit difficult to reconcile. Even if the administration hadn't come to a final position on this issue in the last few weeks, it's not clear why they would default to the very most extreme version of the privilege rather than just asking the court for more time to work out their position.
The state secrets grade was part of a broader accountability category in the report card. Could you go through the other areas where you believe the administration isn't making the grade?
Sure. The fact that the administration has thus far defended the legal provision granting immunity to telecommunications companies that cooperated with the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program. When Obama was in the Senate, he was adamant that immunity for telecom companies was completely indefensible. And the administration has now filed a brief in court defending the constitutionality of immunity for the telecom companies.
Now, the report card isn't all bad. For example, one place the administration is doing very well on disclosure is its stance towards FOIA requests, and in particular, the release of those controversial torture memos.
Yes, the release of the torture memos has been an excellent step in the right direction, not only because it enables the public to see what was at issue in some of these policies that we've heard so much about, but also because of the broader signal that he is not going to continue the Bush administration's reliance on secret law. Because these opinions are more than just descriptions of policies. These opinions are authoritative legal interpretations that are binding on the entire executive branch. So they have the force of law. And to have legal tools like these kept secret from the public is a real problem.
Now, this may seem trivial, but one area where you do give the administration an excellent grade is for simply releasing the president's schedule, letting the public know not just where he's cutting ribbons, but also to whom he's giving Oval Office access.
Right, because when you just put together a list of all of the president's public appearances, which is what has happened under past administrations, you really don't learn anything more than you would learn from picking up the newspaper. And what you really don't learn is what are the priorities of the administration in terms of what are the policies they're working on? Who are they meeting with? What interests are they listening to? And so having that information really does provide you with much more insight.
Now, at the risk of sounding overprotective of our Barry, do you in no way give credence to his explanation that he is, you know, at the moment running two wars, an economy in flames, and that getting the Comptroller General up to speed on the state secret privilege, you know, might not necessarily be his first priority at the moment?
You know, I think it's really too early to say. But I do think that transparency is such a key part of restoring the rule of law that it really needs to be a priority for him, understanding, obviously, that his plate is very full. But this really is one of the top priority items. And it is an item that his administration has, you know, in the past many, many times said is a priority for them as well.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Elizabeth Goitein is director of the Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law.
To the untrained eye, the White House's media strategy for the first 100 days has been relatively simple. Put the president in front of the cameras every chance you get. But there's more to it than that. One media tactic that surprised LA Times reporter Peter Walston was used after the rescue of ship Captain Richard Phillips from the Somali pirates. The administration released a minute-by-minute account of the White House state of play.
It was kind of along the lines of President receives update, President calls, President receives update, President receives update. It wasn't fit for a Hollywood movie script. Keep in mind, they wanted us to know that only after the incident ended successfully from the U.S. perspective.
But they don't always release those play-by-plays, those TikToks, as they say in media parlance, do they?
Oh, no, they don't. But when there's a major decision made, you will see, in many cases, anonymous sources discussing the internal deliberations of the White House. Usually, there is a give and take behind the scenes in the administration, and then the president will, as it's portrayed by the White House officials, make a decisive decision.
It always follows the same storyline.
It seems to, yeah. And there was a sense during the Bush administration that opposing viewpoints were squelched. They want everyone to know that the president is hearing from many different voices, and then he makes a decisive decision. That's the side of this president that the White House wants us to see.
Do you get the sense that the Obama administration is playing favorites with certain news organizations? I mean, Fox News seemed to function as a PR arm for the Bush White House. Do you see anything like that emerging in Obama's first 100 days?
If it were going on, I may not see it because I don't follow that part of it as closely. One interesting development on that front, however, the Obama White House seems to relish the chance to use Fox News as a foil. Robert Gibbs will often refer to something as a Fox News-driven conspiracy or a Fox News-driven theory. They like having Fox News out there as kind of a whipping boy a little bit.
I would imagine that Fox News likes it, too.
I think Fox loves it. And during the campaign, every time Obama would mention Sean Hannity during a speech, if you watched Sean Hannity's show that night, you know, three quarters of the show would be devoted to a full analysis of what Barack Obama meant from every possible angle. And oftentimes it would involve interviews with Karl Rove and Newt Gingrich.
Joe Ward of The Washington Times recently interviewed Press Secretary Robert Gibbs and Deputy Communications Director Dan Pfeiffer. And they talked about how our crowded, fractured media landscape can work to the president's advantage because no single outlet or handful of outlets can drive the daily narrative.
They have a much wider range of options for putting a story out there. They recently gave an exclusive interview of Michelle Obama and her mother to Essence magazine. That interview has been quoted by almost every major media outlet in the country, and it's part of a broader White House strategy to control the image of the family. And this bigger and wider array of news outlets gives them the option to choose someone who will write about it from a favorable viewpoint, which is not a guarantee from the major media.
Well, let's drill down on that celebrity media issue. How central is this to their overall media strategy?
It is a key piece. There's a few reasons why the White House wants to make deals with the celebrity media. One is they can help build a certain image of the Obamas as kind of an all-American family. The other piece is also very important to the White House, which is controlling the paparazzi. When the Obamas were on vacation in Hawaii, that's where these pictures of a shirtless Barack Obama showed up online. So how does the White House control it? Well, they do so by deliberately and steadily releasing intimate photos of the Obamas and their kids. But there's also an economic argument here, which is very interesting. Releasing the photos reduces the demand. Why should People magazine spend $20,000 on a paparazzi photo when they can get a very interesting, provocative photo of the Obamas and their daughters for free from the White House?
Like it or not, and I guess now the administration likes it, even if it didn't at the beginning of this, 100 days is a familiar and time-worn gauge for measuring the effectiveness of an administration. What were the Obama administration's principal challenges during this 100-day period, and how well do you think they did?
The biggest challenge for their message was to somehow maintain and even build on the president's popularity at a time that the public was feeling great strain. And part of why it was so important to engage with the celebrity press, as we've been discussing, and these other strategies, is that they knew that they needed to make sure Americans liked Barack Obama and that they trusted him and that no matter what was happening with his policies, that people felt that he was at least trying to do the right thing and that he was on their side. That was the biggest challenge. So far, they've been successful.
Peter, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Peter Walston writes about national politics for the LA Times. To be sure, some presidents' first 100 days are rockier than others. Bill Clinton's, for instance, were marked by controversy. Towards the end of those inaugural days, when a reporter asked communications director George Stephanopoulos why the White House seemed, quote, wobbly, he answered, On the campaign trail, you can just change the subject, but you can't just change the subject as president. Since then, the media landscape has changed, accounting for 24-hour cable news, not to mention the seismic impact of the internet. But the game is still the same, a tug of war over control of the daily narrative. We asked Clinton's first press secretary, Dee Dee Myers, to reflect on her first days as she watched the Obama team adjust to the White House. She says the Obama transition seems more focused.
I was extremely envious of their transition. The Clinton transition had been rockier. I think we were so distracted by both the transition and by some of the scandals that grew out of that, including the president's pledge to allow gays to serve openly in the military, finding the right attorney general, a few other things that happened. We didn't come to that first day with the same kind of laser-like focus on how do we hit the ground running.
In fact, the very first subject of one of your very first press briefings became an ongoing problem for the Clinton White House. It was the issue of Hillary Clinton chairing the health care task force.
I wouldn't have remembered that. How we block these things. But yes, that's an excellent example of something that was a strategic imperative, which was doing something about health care, but became politically complicated because Mrs. Clinton was put in charge of that effort. And so from the beginning, there were two storylines there. How are they going to fix health care? And what's Hillary doing? And so, you know, we had to battle both of those fronts, and it was distracting.
At that briefing, a reporter asked you, why is the meeting closed, that is, of the task force? And you replied, why is the meeting closed? Because the task force meetings will continue to be closed throughout the development of the policy. That can't have felt good.
It's one of those answers that you give and you know you're going to have to answer the same question every day for the next 100 or 1,000 days. The healthcare process is a good example of, and I think everybody involved in it look back and say there's a lot of things we could have and should have done differently. And one of them was to have a more open process, because not only would that have helped us engage the American public, but you catch your mistakes. All of a sudden you send something out there and people go, oh, no, not that. And I think the Obama team has done a good job in most cases of trying to make the process transparent. Look, I think a lot of the senior Obama team were people that lived through the Clinton administration in one form or another and learned from the mistakes and in more power to them. If all that led to something good coming out of it, then all was not in vain.
It's a much more crowded and fragmented media environment now than it was during the Clinton period. They can use that to their advantage, right?
It seems to be a little harder for a story from one corner of the room to get traction.
Can you give me an example of that?
I'll give you an example from the Clinton administration. President Clinton got his hair cut one day on Air Force One. This was in the spring of the first year. And there was what turned out to be a false report that it had tied up air traffic around the country because his plane had sat there on the tarmac at LAX, prohibiting other planes from landing and rippling across the nation into a traffic jam. That story took off. Now, in this current media environment, would that story have the same reach? Maybe not. There was a way that certain very powerful news organizations, the New York Times, the networks, the Washington Post, would get onto a story and drive the room at a briefing and drive the media. And so I think sometimes those kinds of stories don't take off in the same way.
Comparing and contrasting the first 100 days of Clinton's administration with George Bush Sr.'s and with Obama's, one thing that jumps out at us is the change in communications technology. George H.W. Bush had to reckon with cable news a little bit, but it didn't have enough influence to set the news agenda during most of the Bush years. Bush Sr. also didn't have to reckon with the internet, and I don't think for the first 100 days you did either, did you?
When I went to the White House with President Clinton, there were three networks, CNN, CNBC was just emerging, there were no other cable outlets, and there was no internet. And so you had a much more condensed media environment. So I think there's no question that changes in technology have changed everything. I think the Obama administration, starting in the campaign, really did a masterful job of integrating old and new media. So they pay attention to both Meet the Press and what the New York Times is saying on any given day, and also to Twitter and to various blogs and to the traffic they generate on the internet through their massive list of contacts. And it's a very integrated strategy that lets them reach a lot of people who are getting their news in a lot of different ways.
Are you envious of the toolbox they have at their disposal that you didn't have?
That's a the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away kind of question. I mean, you have a lot more tools, but you have a lot more demand too. And when I think about, yes, you have a lot of opportunities for creative strategy, but you're also on the hook for hundreds of news outlets that want something from the White House every day. So whether it's ABC News or somebody's website that has an audience and is worth communicating with, it just means that there's dozens more items on your to-do list every day. I mean, I think it's in the president's interest ultimately, but it makes for a long day for the White House press secretary.
Dee Dee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dee Dee Myers was the White House press secretary during President Clinton's first 100 days. She's also the author of the book, Why Women Should Rule the World.
Coming up, journalism's strategic gladhanders and historic deceivers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A new administration presents a new roster of potential sources for White House reporters. So it's no surprise that 100 days in, reporters are still working to cultivate the new crew. One time-honored tactic is the story known as the beet sweetener. It's essentially a puff piece written in an effort to win favor and secure access to a source. Blogger Glenn Greenwald made waves in March when he accused The New Yorker's Ryan Lizza of writing a, quote, love letter to White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. Politico's Michael Calderone ponders the latest crop of purported beet sweeteners and their place in the Washington ecosystem. Michael, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
All right. First, describe what a beet sweetener is.
What's telling about a lot of beet sweeteners is oftentimes they rely on quotes from colleagues and basically gratuitously flattering speech. They talk about how hardworking the person is. They are in the office 14 hours a day. They're always within earshot of the president.
And they never say, and by the way, he's widely reputed to be a high-strung jerk.
No, you never hear that. And also with the beet sweetener, it is early in administration. You have a lot of new people coming in, a lot of new blood, and especially those underneath their superiors might want to curry favor with their own superiors in a beet sweetener by saying how hardworking their boss is and how much he gets done in the White House and how things would just not function if he wasn't there.
So it's actually a food chain of sweetening that goes on. Can you give some examples from the last few months? Did you, for example, think that Ryan Lizza's New Yorker piece on Emanuel was a beet sweetener?
I think Lizza's piece qualifies. It was full of the sort of flattering language. There was a line about him being the John McEnroe of the White House. And while it did touch upon some of his negative qualities, that he's profane or that he's difficult to deal with at times, overwhelmingly, it showed, you know, a political figure who is kind of essential to the workings of the White House. One of the White House figures that's been profiled to death has been Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary. And this beet sweetener could be seen as a way for reporters who are in the briefing room with Gibbs day after day to want to curry favor with him.
So Glenn Greenwald's suspicion fell on Ryan Lizza partly because he has a fat book deal to cover the Obama presidency. which I guess reminded him and many people of Bob Woodward's ultimate beet sweetener, his first book on the George W. Bush administration, which was widely perceived as too soft on the president, but only to be followed by two other books that were much harsher. Is that why Lizza is in the spotlight here?
I think that has a lot to do with it. Liz's piece was kind of aptly titled The Gatekeeper, and Rahm Emanuel being chief of staff is somebody that could really inhibit your access to the White House if he wanted to. So the fact that Ryan Lizza, in addition to reporting for The New Yorker, has a six-figure book contract, it calls into question whether Lizza is considering, while writing a piece for The New Yorker, that he still needs access to be able to complete his book. Without access to the White House, that six-figure book deal could just fall apart.
So now what follows is a defense of beet sweeteners. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with them in general. We're talking about new players in Washington. This gives the readers an opportunity to meet and learn about these people. And at a stage of the administration that there's nothing really to be adversarial about, they're just profiles of, you know, why must they be aggressive?
Defenders of the beet sweetener will say that the reader is getting something out of it. The reader is getting to better understand that there are unsung players in the White House who perform a variety of tasks and are not going to be the people on TV. Early on in the administration, first 100 days, it's hard to find as much to be critical about some of these people. As time goes by, I think it's inevitable that the Washington Press Corps will find as many possible flaws as they can.
At which point, if a beet sweetener has opened channels of access, it turns out to help the reporter and therefore the reader get inside when the conversation isn't so polite.
Sure, the reporter can get sources in the White House. Later on, when there might be some sort of shakeup, the reporter might be able to rely on some of those sources to actually get the real story that's going on behind the scenes for the readers.
Okay, what's the conclusion? What's the moral? What have we learned?
I can't condemn the flattering profile as the worst sin committed in journalism. I think it's sort of one of the customs in the Washington Press Corps, and it's something to always be mindful of when you're reading some of these profiles, you know, what may be the agenda of all the parties involved.
Let the buyer beware. Michael, thank you so much.
All right, thanks so much.
Michael Calderon writes for Politico.com. Ryan Lizza, the New Yorker writer whose Rahm Emanuel profile we discussed, wrote another profile this week of Peter Orszag, head of the Office of Management and Budget. In it, Lizza details squabbles between Orszag and another White House economist, Larry Summers. In one passage, Lizza relates a story attributed to a senior White House official of how the two men's staffs fought over who would sit in the seat opposite Obama during budget meetings. Huh, maybe beet sweetening has its rewards after all.
Eric Burns is the author of All the News Unfit to Print, a catalog of journalistic misdeeds dating back to, well, before the American Revolution. Not all the malefactors in his compendium are American, but one thing they do have in common is their flawed humanity.
Journalists lie or misbehave for a variety of reasons. And in Samuel Johnson's case, it was, on the one hand, laziness. He just didn't like to get out of his equivalent of a bathrobe. And he was also quite embarrassed about his appearance. He was ungainly in physique. He had a pockmarked face. And so when he got a job with a magazine called Gentleman's Quarterly to cover Parliament, which he did every day for more than 2 years, he showed up at Parliament once.
And yet he managed to write verbatim the speeches of the parliamentarians on the floor, hence his regret.
Basically, Brooke, the way it worked was that Johnson knew the members of the House of Commons. He knew how they felt about various issues. He knew who was scheduled to speak and on what issue on a given day. And so he just wrote the dialogue or the monologues for them, which raises the question, I think, didn't they ever complain? And the answer is no, they never complained, because Samuel Johnson was so much more eloquent than they that they would rather have Johnson's paraphrase of their sentiments appear in the Gentleman's magazine than they would their own words. As a result, we do not know to this day exactly what went on in Parliament between, I think, 1720 and early 1723.
And we'll always have the lasting impression that that was a particularly eloquent school of parliamentarians. Now, the biggest, best, and the worst, I think, liar in your book is the unrepentant, incorrigible Samuel Clemens, who lied for laughs, yes. He lied for a cause, and he lied for his own enrichment.
He lied as well, I think, Brooke, because he just didn't care that much about journalism. He got bored, so he made up, for instance, an ossified, which is to say a petrified man in the desert who never existed. Clemens just thought it would be a good idea to write about one. He had some strong feelings about those who speculated in stocks and wrote about a terribly bloody massacre in which a speculator had his scalp cut off and bled to death. Well, that never happened either. And Clemens defended this on the notion that, as the Bible tells parables to illustrate a point, I am, in effect, telling a parable to illustrate a point.
But you reserve your own greatest disgust for the time that he basically, well, go ahead and say it.
Well, he sold out in a manner that most journalists before and since have never sold out. He was looking at labor and management struggles, very much a liberal, very much on the side of the laborer, the working man. And suddenly, when he was living in Buffalo and was the editorial page editor of Buffalo's leading newspaper, he took management side and excoriated the working men for wanting more than they did. Not only that, but next to his editorial, he published another editorial from a New York City paper. This, as I said, was Buffalo, which supported his position. And people were astonished, wondering how he could have changed his mind to the extent that he did. Well, as it happened, he was engaged to be married to the
mine owner's
daughter. He sold out his point of view because he didn't want his fiance to be upset with him or his future father-in-law.
Now, he wrote about what he did, and this is why I called him unrepentant. Will you read what he said about lying and the press?
The wise thing is for us diligently to train ourselves to lie thoughtfully, judiciously, to lie firmly, frankly, squarely, with head erect, not haltingly, tortuously, with pusillanimous mien, as being ashamed of our high calling. My concluding sentence to that chapter is, there is no reason to think he was kidding.
Let's take a moment for William Randolph Hearst. We had his biographer and an historian of so-called yellow journalism on the show just a few weeks ago, and both said that Hearst had been given a bad rap, that his paper produced some of history's best reporting, and that his opposition to Spain's merciless domination of Cuba, which led to the Spanish-American War, was heartfelt and genuine.
Well, I concede in All the News Unfit to Print that one of Hearst's motivations was that he felt a genuine sympathy for the way the Cuban people were being mistreated by the Spaniards. I also say that another motivation was circulation. His paper was the New York Journal. He was in a circulation war at the time with Joseph Pulitzer's New York World. When the war finally started, the New York Journal, Hearst's paper, ran a banner at the top for 2 days, which said, "How do you like the Journal's war?" There were so many complaints that he had to drop that. But if he were sincerely concerned primarily with the fate of the Cubans, I don't think he would have been bragging about having started a war.
Walter Duranty, the New York Times reporter in Moscow in the 20s and 30s, won a Pulitzer in 1932, one that even the Times would be glad if the Pulitzer board would take it back. But the board has refused.
Well, there's a sense in which he deserved the Pulitzer because he won it for a 13-part series on what the Soviet Union was like under Stalin, and there was a lot of information in it that Americans didn't know. Unfortunately, there was something that wasn't in it, and that was what has later been considered officially by government bodies an act of genocide that Stalin was perpetrating by having created a famine in the province of Ukraine. Stalin had a five-year program, and the goal was in 5 years for the Soviet Union to be technologically and industrially the equal of the United States. One of the ways that he had to do that was that he had to make sure his workers in the more industrialized provinces had enough to eat, had enough energy to work their endless shifts. And so he had soldiers steal grain, steal foodstuffs from the relatively backward province of Ukraine. The result was that millions of people died by a famine that was man-made. And Walter Duranty, because he was a Stalinist, because he was so loved by Stalin for his reporting that he was the only Western reporter ever to interview Stalin, Walter Duranty refused to report on this because it went against his political views. And when he finally, because so many other newspapers in Great Britain and the United States were reporting on it, when he finally turned his attention to it, the first thing he said was, "Reports of the famine are bunk." It was, Brooke, in many ways, one of the most disreputable acts ever performed by a journalist. Part of the reason that there was such a powerful anti-communist effort in this country in the 50s, Joe McCarthy led it, was that there was also powerful sentiment in this country for Stalin, that communism was the answer to such excesses of capitalism as the Great Depression. And part of the reason so many Americans believed in communism as the answer to capitalism's excesses was that people like Walter Duranty did not report at the start the massive failures of Stalin's program.
Jumping off of Duranty, you have a fairly long discussion of what you call lies of omission. Mm-hmm. Rarely do they achieve the breadth and horror of what Duranty left out of his stories. In fact, some more fastidious news consumers might wish that reporters would withhold more of the details of the sexual peccadilloes of our leaders as they did generations earlier.
Well, there were two topics that in the middle of the 20th century were simply not reported on when it came to covering government officials: their sex lives outside of marriage and their drinking habits. Again, the New York Times comes to mind. I've forgotten the reporter's name, but there was a very close vote on a very important issue one day, and a senator had to be carried into the chamber because he was so hungover from the night before.
What era was this?
This was in the 50s. And the woman who was covering this story for the New York Times said this was part of the story. There's a chance that this man might not have been able to get to the chambers to cast his vote. And if he hadn't, it was a tie vote. The court of this legislation would have changed. I'm not, this reporter said to her editor, I'm not trying to write something prurient. I'm trying to tell the whole story of how this bill was passed. Sex lives were also thought to be off limits. And in fact, Wendell Willkie, who challenged FDR for the presidency once, was so well known to have a mistress in New York that he decided to have a press conference once in her apartment. Now, one of his advisors talked him out of it, but reporters had in their, whatever the predecessor of a Rolodex was, the phone number of Wilkie's mistress. And when they needed to reach him for a quick quote, the first call went to the mistress, the second call went to his home. None of that ever appeared in a publication.
Finally, many media watchers and old-time practitioners lament that in this age of blogs and Twitter and broken business models and blah, 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 that journalistic ethics are being eroded so much that it imperils our very republic. But your book makes the case that there never really was a golden age, and yet the republic endures.
There never was a golden age. From the very beginnings of journalism, we've had people who, because of ideological bias, who because of laziness, who because of a lack of respect for the profession, did not care enough about their story to make sure that it was accurate. one of the reasons that the Republic is not imperiled by irresponsible journalism is that we have had such an explosion in journalistic outlets. Yes, we're losing newspapers, but we're certainly gaining on the internet. That irresponsible journalism is going to be detected today more easily than it ever was before. So we have two things going in contrary directions at once. Because we have so many journalistic outlets, the odds are greater that we'll have erroneous coverage. Because we have so many journalistic outlets, the odds are greater that some of that coverage will point out the errors in some of the other coverage.
So not the collapse of civilization?
No, not even the collapse of journalism.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Brooke.
Eric Burns is the author of the new book, All the News Unfit to Print.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Cara Gianfrido, Ethan Cheel, and Andy Lancet, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Burrell.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.